And doing something that has a little bit of fantasy. It's a magical realism story. And I feel like the biggest inspiration for that book is probably Miyazaki films, which are often about real kids and real world settings, but then at some point the narrative just kind of gets crazy. And there are creatures, and then the kids start to fly, and there's always like some twist on it that makes you wish that you could live in that world too. So Ghosts was just my chance to do something like that. Just what world would I like to live in, and what cool things would I like to see happen? And I was really intimidated because I was like, I'm really good at drawing things if I can look at them, but I don't know what ghosts look like. I have to make that up. And that was challenging for me. But again, the setting is a real world setting, so it's kind of combining the two things.
So it's interesting because Shade, the changing girl, is a 16-year-old girl. It's an alien that possesses a 16-year-old. But she's 22, and she's navigating sort of young adult space. And it's the first time that I'm on an imprint that's actually a mature imprint, but dealing with a young character. But I also have a book called Soupy Leaves Home that comes out next year, which is a middle grade about a girl who runs away from home and rides the rails in 1932 with the hobos. And I kind of realized that like both sort of deal with grief, and I think comics lend itself really well to dealing with grief because there are places to pause. I read a lot of adventure comics when I was growing up, but I remember in high school, I read this comic called Our Cancer Year, and it was just this beautiful sort of, you just rested your eyes on the page and were filled with emotions, and I think that I've always thought about that, and I've always thought about how comics lend itself so well to that. And, you know, I write prose, but there are times where there are no words for what I want to say, and that's when I turn to writing comics.
Hello. I have never written a graphic novel or comic book.
Yet.
Yet. I suck. But I'm here because, number one, I love Boom Studios. They did and these really cool little graphic novels for the DVD release of The Maze Runner that were original stories set within the movie world version of Maze Runner. And then they did a standalone for the second movie that was just so awesome. But I have been a lover of graphic novels and comic books since I was a little kid. I had a sleepover, and this dude in my neighborhood had a literal giant wooden, trunk, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah. And it was like just something out of a movie. He opened it up, and it felt like golden light was spilling out, because it was full of comic books. And it was really my first exposure. They were not porn magazines, is what you would think would happen at that age. They were comic novels, or comic books. And just something about adding that visual element to storytelling that I love, and I'd like to do more of. And so I'm just excited to be here as a storyteller and to learn from these guys about it.
I can crimp from little bits of everybody. same. On the line. Miyazaki changed my life. I was a young teenager and getting further and further down the rat hole of dude bro comics in the 90s. And as everyone my age and my makeup did, I guess, we all bought Spawn number one. did we love it?
I don't know. I checked it out in the library.
Yeah. But I think it wasn't really my jam, it wasn't really my heart, and what it took was this guy, J.P. Lawrence, coming back from his exchange year in Japan, and he had taken the family's VHS player, they had allowed him to record their Ghibli laser discs, and he threw this thing in front of me, and he was like, "You need to watch this." And I put in Nausicaa, and I was like, "Oh, that's Warriors of the Wind. I watched that. It looked great, and it seemed like it was something, but it was a weird 90-minute dub of something I didn't understand. But now I got to understand what these movies really were, and Totoro in particular was the thing that I felt hit my reset button and made me go, "Oh, that's who I am. That was the storytelling that I really fell in love with, and that's my..." It's kind of closer to my creative core and what I would want to express when I grow up. And I've never forgotten that. It was super profound. And now being a creator in comics, that's kind of my goal. I don't always get to do that. Like, Batgirl was a really incredible opportunity for me, but there was a mandate out of the gate that it was to be made for 21 to 28-year-olds, so there was a direction given to make sure that, you know, there was booze and sex, and we kind of skirted that line in our first issue. Then we went and did a convention appearance, and there was an 11-year-old girl wearing a Batgirl outfit, hoping to get the issue signed, and my heart just sank. I was like, we can't do this. I don't care what they say. This is a book called Batgirl, and parents shouldn't have to worry whether or not they should be able, whether they can buy a book called Batgirl for their 10-year-old. So we kind of aged it down and brought it closer to where it felt right. And the sister book I was working on at the same time was Gotham Academy, and it was always in that space. It's, for me, made for my now 10-year-old niece. And that's the space I'm happiest in, and I feel like it's the space that isn't really being given great attention in the direct market. Except for, Except for great books by you guys. I'm just going to sit here and put my foot in my mouth over and over again.
The direct market is for anyone.
The direct market is a... Well, maybe you... Yeah.
No, you.
Oh, me? Okay. So So there's all these different ways to get books. And comics has a weird setup where we used to be able to go into grocery stores and corner stores, and there were these racks, and you could just pull them off, and they weren't in great shape, but it didn't matter because they were 75 cents, and you could read them, and then your mom could toss them out. But they were tough to track, and those shops weren't always around, and the comic book companies figured out a way to get them into places like record stores and head shops, but they had to send them direct to them, and those guys had to buy them, so then they would keep them, and over time, these places became comic stores, because in the book market, if a book doesn't sell, you can send it back to the publisher, but if you do this direct purchase, it stays in your shop, and then your shop is filled with boxes and boxes of comics, and we still have that, and they're comic stores, and they're great places to buy comics, but they tend to cater to a different market. Then we have bookstores like Barnes & Noble that I feel like I'm screwing this up. And indie bookstores.
Yeah, good call. Indie bookstores!
And they have make returnable orders that are massive, but they also serve families and people who don't know what comic book stores are or why they might want to go to them.
And is it? Don't you feel like the section's a lot bigger than it used to be?
Yeah, but also it's like, I mean, like DC Comics, they do like Scooby. I mean, they do things for little kids, too.
Yeah.
That's part of the direct market as well.
It is.
Yeah.
Do direct market comic stores order those books?
Well, I don't know. That's a totally different conversation. But I have a question for everyone. Because, I mean, all of our work has been just in YA or middle grade, right? Except for you, maybe, because Batgirl was started off older. But I'm curious as to, like, what... Like, I know for me, it's interesting to write YA, you know, comics or prose, because for me, I feel like characters at that time are so raw and open and experiencing things for the new time, for the first time. But for me, a lot of people ask me, oh, well, you know, how did you come to YA? And for me, I always wanted to write YA. That was my rock star thing. It was like children's book authors. So I'm just curious about you, because I know some people accidentally, you know, they're like, oh, and then they just marketed it that way.
I think I started out as they just marketed it that way camp, but I've definitely moved over into the intentionally writing mostly YA and grade and for younger readers camp. Just because it comes pretty naturally, and I'm good at it, and I've learned to recognize that that's a skill, and not something to be looked down upon. Because lots of people who write for adults are terrible at writing for children.
Yeah.
Well, I have a great story to follow that up. I'm really good friends with Shannon Hale, who has some of her own graphic novels. One of her favorite stories is an author that I will not name came up to her after she had written
Rapunzel's Revenge? No. Princess Academy? No.
The sequel to Goose Girl.
Oh, the Goose Girl.
Anyway, this guy said to her, oh, he's a man. I gave that away. Shocker. He said, wow, this book is really good. I think you're ready to write for adults.
I've had that, yeah.
And it's just such BS.
Have you ever gotten that? Like, oh, when are you going to write an adult book?
Oh, yes.
It's like, I have written an adult book. It's called a book.
Yeah.
That you can read. I mean, that's the great thing about YA, right? Or middle grade, is that there's a reason why, and especially with all ages. I mean, look at Tintin, right? Hergé used to say, these books are for age 7 to 77. And I think that when you write a book for young people, when you write a comic book for young people, it really is the true meaning of all ages. Because you can grow with that book.
But all ages is a really problematic term.
It is a problematic term.
People use that within the direct market a lot to sort of put things on a shelf and say, it's friendly, it's friendly. But I do think that, like, comic strips that were in the newspaper, which is what I grew up reading, were meant to be for a wide audience. Everybody from 7 to 77. Yes. And you start reading them when you're a kid and you fall in love with them and then you keep reading them. I think the same is true of the superhero genre, that you start getting into those when you're a teenager or younger, and then you stick with it, and you turn into a fanboy. No, I don't know if that's true. But, I mean, as far as like, the concept of YA, I feel like that did not exist when I was a kid. There was not such a thing as a YA section in a bookstore.
Yeah.
You went from Babysitter's Club to
Steve
Andrews.
Yeah, to genre.
Stephen King was my YA section.
Yeah, yeah, and for me, I did, for me too, yeah, I think Stephen King was big for a lot of us in the 80s and 90s, but I discovered Lynn LeBarry's comics when I was about 12, and that changed everything. I was like, oh my gosh, here's somebody who's writing about like the angst of what it's like to be 12 and how hard your life can be and how much harder these kids' lives are than mine. So I think of Lynn LeBarry as like my YA before YA existed. And I think she was hugely informative to the types of comics that I would want to write when I was a little bit older.
Well, Raina, you have a very big adult audience.
Isn't that weird?
So, I mean,
just I don't think it is.
No, I don't think it's weird at all. I'm saying it's a huge compliment to you that your books... like you're saying, the YA thing is... I don't know what my point is.
Well, I think it's like what you're saying. It's because I think it shows that it's all ages, but the term all ages has been co-opted to mean something that it's not. And
like
it's
yeah. That's really ultimately what all ages means in the direct market, is that it's inoffensive.
But I also didn't set out to write comics for children. And it was really Scholastic that took a look at my work and said, we think that your work is going to be suitable for 8 to 10-year-olds. And I was like, okay, you guys probably know what you're doing. I mean, Scholastic's been in the business for a very long time. And they're very, very good at getting books into kids' hands. So I think as far as like marketing my books, they are marketed towards younger readers. But I know that there are a lot of adults that like them too. But adults often see the covers and they're like, oh, bright, shiny, happy face. That's obviously a children's book.
Okay.
But I think the best children's books speak to adults as well.
We've gone through this with Gotham Academy exactly where, I mean, the readership, the Batman readership ignored it because they thought it was a kid's book because there's two young ladies on the cover of the first issue. And I think the direct market audience has kind of learned to accept that it's a differently flavored Batman comic, and there might be clues to the meta story that they're, you know, always hunting down year after year so that they need to read it. But what was really interesting for us was being confronted by librarians at the American Librarians Association conference and being asked, where do we shelve this?
Right.
And we were like, oh, it's all ages, and they're like, no, it's not. There is no such thing as all ages because we have to put it somewhere in the library. We want you guys to tell us. And we were like, oh.
What did you say? Middle grade, YA?
Yeah, middle grade, YA. It's,
no, but middle grade or YA.
YA, sorry.
Yeah. Which one, Brendan?
It's all ages.
No? Well, at least at Barnes & Noble, the comics graphic novel section is its own section, right? Mm-hmm. So it's actually not divided by age.
Yeah,
or is
it? But also it's like, I mean, that's problematic. Like when The Plain Janes came out, on DC Comics, which was aimed for girls, they wouldn't put any comics in the YA section, and they wouldn't age the graphic novels section either. So it was just, everything was just a mishmash. And now that's changing. But
I had this conversation the other night because I go into these Barnes and Nobles because I'm always checking up on stuff.
Take it out. Turn it.
I almost did, because the one that's right near me in Brooklyn has two sections. I don't know if they're all the same, but there's the graphic novel section, and then in the, what is it, the young adult section, mm-hmm. there's a YA graphic novel section, and it really bummed me out that but my Gotham Academy book is filed with Batman, and when I go over to the YA section, it's not over there, but Lumberjanes is over there, and then I'm like, where is the Lumberjanes Gotham Academy book going to go?
Right.
A big shelf dedicated to it in between, right?
Right. Yeah, it'll be on its own display, obviously.
Right in front of the main door.
Well, I think those are some of the questions that retailers are grappling with, like, how do we categorize this stuff, because you don't want a book that's appropriate for kids to be next to a graphic novel that's for 18 and older readers.
Yeah.
Like a Vertigo book and a graphic book and a Scholastic don't necessarily need to sit next to each other. And when parents or educators or librarians are sort of browsing these things and seeing them next to each other for the first time, like, I'm a new graphic novel person, I can hear your buzz on graphic novels, they're seeing these two things against each other and kind of don't know, like, how to make sense of it. So you need a category, but, with what
Gotham Academy sits next to Gotham Central.
But,
I want parents to be able to walk into a store and be like, oh, okay, this is appropriate for my 6-year-old kid or my 8-year-old kid or whatever.
But at the same time, it's like, I find it sad because I find it sad that some people willfully don't discover any book that is in a YA section because they think, oh, that's not like the Gotham Academy thing or with my Princess Leia novel or, you know, Plain Jane's, where it's like, oh, well, that book's not for me because it's for...
I mean, those people are going to look at the books and be like, there's a teen girl on the cover, not for me anyway. So I don't think that shelving those books with the adult comics is gonna really win you all that many readers.
Well, but I think when you're doing something like Gotham Academy that has, that's in the Bat World, or, you know, Princess Leia's prose, but Princess Leia, you know, it's like, well, it counts. It's canon, so, you know.
It does count, it is canon, and it doesn't, there are secrets of the world of Gotham in there that
right.
will affect the rest of the Bat Line. I don't know. You could ask the same with, like, the Maze Runner books. You can stick them in YA. You can also stick them in fiction, right? Because adults are going to want to check that out, but they're maybe not going to want to wind their way into YA.
I've always wondered if maybe they... I know for at least Twilight, they did a more adult-looking version of it.
Changed the cover.
And shelved it in the adult section as well.
Yeah, Harry Potter, too, I think in the UK they did that.
Did they?
Mm-hmm.
But I think...
Yeah.
Things like my books, Hunger Games, Harry Potter, Twilight, Divergent. I mean, if it weren't for the adult readers, they just would not be as big as they are. And I think, luckily, people just gotten over that stigma. They don't care. They walk to the YA section and buy cool books.
That's amazing, too. I mean, a huge percentage of YA readers are not young adults. They're
right.
adults.
Yep.
It's just like, it's like a flavor that you like to read. I don't think it's stigmatized the way it used to be.
I think I read a statistic that it's like 65%.
Yes, that's what I heard too.
65% of young adult readers are women over 35.
Oh, I know my readership is well over 50% adults. Easily.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about literacy. It's a key component to growth of comics for younger readers. And I've met a number of teenagers and then college-bound young adults and parents who attest that comics helped these kids excel in reading, and it turned them on to prose, and it turned them on to wanting to be writers themselves. I was talking to the editor-in-chief at Boom, I hope he doesn't mind when I tell this story, about how he was able to meet Jim Davis, the creator of Harvard Literacy, and it gave him an opportunity to sort of thank Jim Davis for his work, because it was some of the first books that he learned how to read. And I had a similar experience. My older brother had those graphic books, and I just labored over them. And, you know, those are those first sets. And some of those comics are newspaper syndicated and for all ages. It was content that was presented to me in a very inviting, safe, engaging way that helped me grow as a reader. It helped Matt Gagnon, our editor-in-chief, grow as a reader. So I'm curious what any experience you all might have talking directly with kids or adults about the transformative effect of comics on reading or in writing. And do you have an opinion on what you think what impact comics has had on modern literacy?
I've heard from a lot of parents that Wrinkle in Time is the first book that their kids ever read on their own, which is really cool to hear. And that has definitely changed the way that I think about my work and the kind of work that I want to be creating.
Yeah, I mean, it comes at me from every direction. I get emails, I get Instagram posts, I get people coming up to me at Comic-Con, at American Library Association Conference, pretty much everywhere I go, both parents and kids that say the same thing. Either I'm a kid, I did not like reading until I started reading your books, or I'm a parent and I'm so grateful that you make these books because now my kid wants to read. And I feel like every graphic novelist I talk to is having really similar conversations with their readers, and it's astounding. And the great thing is that these kids don't just want to read, they also want to write, and then they want to read more, and then they want to read prose books. And so it opens up a door for so many people. And some of these kids are dyslexic, some of them are just not strong as their peers, but some of them just don't have an interest in the material. And that's one nice thing about graphic novels made for middle grade and YA readers, is that kids who might not be up to that level of reading as, like, say, a 10-year-old. Like, a 10-year-old might be reading at, you know, a third grade level, but a graphic novel is probably approachable for them, and if the subject matter is something that they're interested in, they feel like they've read a book that's at their level, even though it's also a book that their six-year-old sister, who's a really strong reader, might read to. So they do have this ability to sort of stretch in both directions.
I want to add one more thing, which is that I don't really know how to, I'm probably going to stumble over the words here because I don't know what the correct terms are for some of the stuff I'm going to be talking about, but I've heard from educators who work with kids with Asperger's and, anyway.
ADHD?
What I've heard is that graphic novels are particularly great for kids with certain experience the world in a different way, and they have a hard time understanding what characters are feeling unless they can see it visually.
Yeah, empathy.
So that's pretty cool.
You know, I've been a volunteer at an elementary school in Los Angeles for 15 years now, over my 16th year this year. And this last year, I mean, so I do read aloud and literacy, and a lot of the kids, it's a Title I school, they don't have books at home, parents are in gangs, maybe in jail. So I bring in books, and I have started working with First Book, which is an organization, and I bring in comic books. But this year I started a book club at school. And one girl brought in A Wrinkle in Time. And she took her whole, and then the whole year to read it. She finally finished reading it. And then I brought in, what was it? I brought in a book, I think I texted you. I brought in a book and, I did a talk about comics and how you write comics and how you read comics. And I put up a picture, and it was a picture from Mercury, which is one of Hope's books. And the girl raised her hand and said, "Is that Hope Larson?" You know, but the thing was is that then she went and she shared A Wrinkle in Time with all of her friends, and they all started reading it. And that's the thing about books, is that if like the physical act of carrying and lugging a book around and being so into it and obsessed with it, and with comics as well, and then sharing that with your friends is the big entry point to literacy. And I think that the great thing about comics is that it eliminates, like, when you're dealing with second graders or third graders, they're, like Raina said, they're all at different reading levels. But when you can share a comic book with your friends, everybody can participate in that book group. So I think that's one of the great things about comics and literacy.
I know I had a very transformative experience, like you said. I don't know if it's cliche to love peanuts.
No, I love peanuts.
Anyway, when I was in one summer, I just noticed your hat. One summer, my mom bought me this 5-book collection of peanuts. And it's so different to read them more like a book, where they're, you know, so connected instead of every day in the newspaper. And it was just, I just ripped through those books, and it really transformed me in my whole storytelling persona. Just these visuals mixed with these, you know, helping me understand the importance of character development, because I felt like I, for the first time, really fell in love with the Peanuts characters, seeing them in these continuous stories. And I think it really influenced my future writing, because I'm a very visual, at least in my head, I'm very visual when I'm writing. I think of it cinematically and then try to translate that to the written word. And I'll just never forget that cool week or two I had ripping through those Peanuts books.
For me, one of the most mind-blowing things of the last few years is that my niece, who's now 10, actually fell in love with a comic that I was writing for her. And I didn't force it on her or anything. You know, I brought them over and I left them there and I said, well, these are the things that I'm working on. And I think it probably took her a couple of months to actually start reading it.
So it wasn't published yet?
No, it was published. It was after it was published. She actually came to our launch, which was really nice, and she sat and read the first issue at launch, but then I waited to have the full book to give it to her. Now she tears through them, and she shares them with all her friends. But beyond that, and I had no knowledge of this, I found this out when I went back home and I stayed with my sister for a while, she brought to my sister this flyer that was like a comic book creation camp in Toronto, and begged to be signed up for it, even though it was for slightly older kids. And so when I came home, I was presented with her first comic that she was making, and like I pretty much burst out into tears. And now she's doing fan art for my characters, and I'm like, I don't even know how to process this. It's amazing. But it's a thing that she would like to do with her life, is make comic books now.
Yeah, to know you've affected someone on that level is pretty amazing.
But the thing is that like when a kid makes a comic book, they like to share the comic books. Like I see that in the school. Like they share, and by sharing, they're sharing like books.
Yeah.
You know?
She's like my greatest advertiser.
You really like your niece.
I really do.
You're the coolest uncle ever.
I got all these photos here. I can bust out. We want to
do
this.
Well, I think something that like the way you're saying is that having access and exposure to one book that will convert a reader and help us change the industry so that we're providing content for kids that is meaningful and transformative and impactful. So I think that's what you're all doing here, helping change that. And that means we'll have more space in the direct market, you know, because those readers are going to start working.
It's happening, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You guys are doing it. It's great.
So, one more question for these guys, and then I'll open it up to audience questions. Something we've touched on a little bit is content, and how would you decide what's the quote-unquote safe content for your audience, especially as it pertains to finance, or sex, or gender, and drug abuse? How have you been faced with backlashes as a result of the choices you've made, and how has that potential backlash impacted your storytelling as you move on to new projects?
I'm looking at you with empathy.
So do you want me to start?
I don't want to start.
Okay,
I'll start.
I mean, it's really specific that I'm working with Scholastic, and Scholastic is a children's book publisher, and I feel like the oldest kid they even publish books for is probably 16 years old. So they're really cognizant of what's appropriate for the age range that I'm writing for. And I think because comics is visual, there are cases where you can talk about something in prose, but you're not actually seeing it happen on the page. And so you can get away with certain content in a way that you cannot with comics, because a comics reader or their parent can just flip it open to page 137 and go, oh my gosh, this inflammatory thing just happened, completely out of context. I'm really upset, and now I'm banning this book from my kid's life forever. So, I mean, at first, like with Smile, I wanted to include a reference to a period, and my editors were like, no, this won't fly. I think that may have changed at this point. I think I might be able to get one in there at some point. That's my main goal in life, is to get a reference to a period in one of my books. That's not true. But with my second book, Drama, I wanted to talk about gay middle school kids. And my editors were 100% behind me. They were like, go for it. This is a conversation that needs to happen, and we stand behind you all the way. And I'm really grateful that they did. And I mean, Drama got onto the ALA's top 10 banned books list a couple of years ago because there are readers in other parts of the country who just don't think it's cool to see two boys kissing. But I'm like, why don't you read the story? Then you'll understand it. But it's a conversation that's always evolving. And I don't write to like push my editors, but I write to push myself. And so I feel like I'm really lucky that I have this publisher to work with, who, even though they are thinking about what's appropriate for kids and what kids can handle and what kids can see at the age that I'm writing for, they're still supportive of the kinds of things I want to talk about.
I think it's really hard, right? Because every kid is different. Like an eight-year-old can be a very wise and sophisticated 8-year-old, and an 8-year-old can still be a baby. And I think that's one of the big challenges in writing for young people is that line is very, very fluid. And so what does that really mean, 8 to 12, or 12 and up, or 14 plus? You know, it's a moving line. For Shade the Changing Girl, like I said, I've got this 16-year-old body that she's in, and she's going to high school, and everybody around is a 16-year-old, but it's a mature line. Like, you know, so Young Animal is like, I can do whatever I want because it's for adults. It's for adults. But I, in a way, have this new freedom that I've never had before because I have this very firmly sort of YA book where it's all young adults, but I don't have the constraint of being marketed as a YA book. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how to navigate that space where I have a book that can deal with sophisticated ideas, but is also completely appropriate for young adults. And that's a challenge because when I'm writing a young adult book, I do have to think about certain things. But then again, you never know what's going to get you uninvited to a school visit, you know? You just don't know. So it's like if you write with that in mind and be like, well, at last, I've written the perfect young person's book where I'll never get banned and no one will be offended by anything. It's like before you even write the book, someone's already mad at you. You know, I talked about the other day. They're already angry, you know?
Yeah. This is something I've thought about a lot over the years, basically over my whole career, like what you can and can't. I get away with is maybe the wrong way to put it, because it implies that I want to like push the envelope as far as I can, and that's not really my goal.
We know that's what you meant.
There are things that I basically stay away from swearing as much as possible. It would really take a lot for me to put a curse word in at this point, even in Batgirl, which is like Brendan said, it's basically a book for women in their 20s. That's how it's being marketed. I know there are kids reading that book, so it's really up to me to self-censor on that one and figure out what I think is what I'm comfortable with, I guess. I've written some books that are, Compass South is pretty violent, actually, and the sequel is a little more so. But I try and just portray that as tastefully as possible. I don't want to have tons of blood gushing everywhere or something like that, but at the same time, it's a pirate book. There's going to be fighting and stuff's going to happen. People die. And I think that's okay. It's just like, how do I direct the action and the visuals in a way that it's not going to traumatize some kid or keep it out of their hands? That's basically what I think about.
This is so random, but I just find it so hilarious that people are so sensitive about periods. All teenage girls have periods, right?
Yeah. Every single one.
Anyway, my thing is definitely violence. Every once in a while, I get some librarian or something who says, you know, why do you feel comfortable having so much violence in your books? And I know it's a touchy subject, especially in today's culture where we see all these violent acts. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's very rare that I purposely write something different, because I'm trying not to be too violent. I just go with my instinct. And usually my editor may pull back a couple of things, but I don't really know the answer. I just know it's a hot topic or a sensitive topic for a lot of people. Because my movies do have a lot of violence. A lot of movies have violence. So it's one of those things where I know it might be a problem, but I have no idea what the solution is. So.
It's quite cathartic. I mean, I have a lot of, and I think a lot of women have a lot of anger, and for me, writing action and writing stuff that's a bit violent is really cathartic, both as a writer and as a reader. And there also aren't, like, a ton of women writing action-y, even slightly violent comics, especially in the traditional publishing industry, so...
Yeah.
I want to do it.
Good. Air high five.
I noticed a big difference for me writing Gotham Academy and Batgirl at the same time, and they would come out like a week apart. The audience is somewhat the same. In Batgirl, we felt okay with her smacking around jerks. We made sure that someone would call them a creep or a jerk. Because it's a bat book, and that's what they do. Gotham Academy, there's a lot of danger and falling off stuff, and floors collapsing, and walls closing in, and it was just about, there are bad guys, but you don't physically confront them as much as you try to, you know, make sure they chase you to a place where a rock's going to fall on them or something. It almost feels like sometimes, and we've talked about this, writing Scooby-Doo, where there were probably these arcane 60s kids show laws in place where you know, had to have action-adventure that had no nobody touching each other in any way, or physical conflict that didn't actually involve physicality. That's not to say we haven't done that stuff in Gotham Academy, but when it happens, we make sure it's a monster. And it's weird, like, we don't have rules, it just feels, in scenes where things like that have happened, we kind of cut away from it, and it's just an instinct. It's like, yeah, I don't want to see that 14-year-old acting out aggressively to that extent with this other person. Let's cut away to the other members of the cast, and then cut back in, and we see the result, and we imply a lot. And it's how we ended up on Batgirl as well, our first, in a different way, with sex and drugs. The first one went maybe a little beyond implication, and then once we realized how young the audience could be, it was like we needed to, you know, despite editorial requests, we felt we needed to self-censor. And that stuff, we would never deny that it's in the world of the character. We're not going to put it on the page. And anytime we address it, it's an implication. It's weird. Same, feels like books, the books in the same universe addressing a lot of the same stuff. I even crossed them over at points. But I just felt like handling all of that gently. And that was, I mean, my co-writers all felt the same. It was just the sense we had.
Do we have time for a question or two? Okay. I'll ask a real quick one. You mentioned about the hard, like, the books passing from kid to kid physically, and I was just wondering what your guys' opinion was on digital comics and digital books for that matter. Like, you can't really pass a digital book to another kid. And I was just wondering what you guys think about that.
My friend said that her kids like digital books because then it can be like midnight and they finish one book and they can immediately download the next one. So kids that are lucky enough to have access to e-readers and parents with credit cards who can keep on spending money on their sites are having it really well, but I think that it still doesn't favor the kids who don't have that access.
I know a lot of libraries, you can get those, you can check those out. I don't know.
Can you check out the
reader? I don't know.
Okay.
That's a good
question. Yeah.
I think maybe something that might have made up for that is just, you know, how connected kids are digitally. So instead of maybe physically passing this comic book around, you know, they're texting or DMing about it, sharing links. I mean, that might make up for it.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I am a children's librarian, so this is not just a question, but I wanted to respond to Brendan talking about not knowing what to say to librarians and ask where to shelve it. The first answer, of course, is buy two copies, the one in your children's library and one in your adult library. And the second thing that I was going to say, too, is that, you know, first of all, you know, I apologize on behalf of those librarians because we really, that's like our job to figure that stuff out, so they shouldn't be asking me that question anyway. But I would say that it's probably a good start for the meetings, if it's truly all in your book, start by putting it in the kids' collection and then tell the librarian, check the circulation, see who's checking it out, you know, if it's working, keep it there. You know, if it's not, then you can always move it. It's not a big deal to move stuff from one collection to the next. You know, and of course, if it's serving really well, you know, then you can buy that second copy. And I found, too, it was mentioned before, but comics fans, graphic novel fans have no problem finding whatever collection anything is in. So, you know, I've seen plenty of adults. I've got like Marvel Masterworks stuff in my kids' collection, and a lot of older comics like Pogo, things like that, and their adults check that stuff out all the time and have a problem with it. You know, and so I think, too, just encouraging librarians to can sell the stuff and to tell people who they know if they're a Batman fan, and you know, oh, you really like Gotham Academy, the librarian should be saying, yeah, I just have this copy in our kids' collection, that you would enjoy as well. So just I thought it might be helpful in terms of knowing what to say next time.
Thank you for being a librarian.
Yeah.